So Israel has already carried out hundreds of airstrikes against Iran's Revolutionary Guard in Syria and its proxies. Yes, it seems that the Iranian regime insists to continue its entrenchment in Syria and even to expand it, not only by deliveries of arms and forces, but also by economic investments under the umbrella of the Russian intervention in Syria. With us, retired General David Petraeus, former director of CIA. Hello.
Good to be with you.
So, in your opinion, can Israel stop Iran's entrenchment in Syria by a combination of military airstrikes and diplomacy?
Well, first of all, let's recognize that what Iran wants to do in Syria is to Lebanonize Syria. By the way, it wants to do the same in Iraq. It wants to do in these two countries what it has done in Lebanon, which is to have muscle on the street in the form of an Iranian-supported paramilitary group, Hezbollah, obviously, in Lebanon, various Shia militia in Syria. But it also wants to have political power in the same way that it has considerable political weight in the parliament in Lebanon. It would like to have the same in some fashion, however it is constructed. Obviously noting the difference that you have quite an authoritarian leader in the form of Bashar al-Assad, but to have a great deal of political influence on him. It's not in any country's interest, I don't think, in this region, frankly, to see that happen. It's certainly not in Israel's, it's not in the United States' interest, nor in, again, that of most other countries in the region. Israel, I think, has done an admirable job in carrying out strikes, pursuing a variety of other activities that have been intended to prevent Iran from getting entrenched in Syria the way that it would like to. And these are mostly, of course, targeting military facilities, the buildup of certain military capabilities that are assessed to be unacceptable from an Israeli security point of view. But really, Israel needs help in this. One of the efforts pursued by the United States in Syria, where the principal purpose, as announced certainly, is the enduring defeat of the Islamic State. But there's also an effort to prevent Iran from establishing a ground line of communications that would connect Iran through Iraq, through Syria, down into southern Lebanon to resupply or enable Hezbollah to have more military capabilities. And it's very much, I think, again, in the Israeli and the U.S. interest to ensure that that does not happen. The Al-Tanf base on the one particular official crossing between Iraq and Syria that is otherwise not as closely guarded as the one that is near Al-Qaim and Husayba, Abu Kamal, on the Syrian side. This other crossing, really much more remote and one that could be exploited were the U.S. Facility there removed. So I'm sure that there are conversations between Israel and the United States on that particular issue and on a host of other issues, frankly, that involve sharing of intelligence. That has certainly helped, I'm sure, as Israel has carried out a variety of actions, again, to prevent Iran from increasing the capabilities that it has on the ground in Iran.
So another issue is the policymaking of the government of Trump's administration right now. We heard about the decision to withdraw forces from Syria, and now, lately, we heard about rethinking or considering to leave some of the forces in Tanf. What is your impression about this policymaking, and particularly in Syria and in the Middle East in general?
Well, first of all, I don't see the U.S. going anywhere from the Middle East. I mean, there's an array of bases that I know really well, obviously, from my time as the commander of U.S. Central Command and also time commanding the forces on the ground in Iraq and there over in Afghanistan. And again, the array of bases in the Gulf states in particular is very substantial, and it is not going anywhere anytime soon. Kuwait, Bahrain, UAE, Qatar, these are enormous facilities, and they're very valuable to the United States, and that will be an enduring presence, I'm sure. There obviously also are more contingency basing arrangements in a number of other countries in the region. And of course, that includes a relatively modest number of forces that are on the ground in Syria. When you talk about Syria, I think it's always good to come back to what are the policy objectives in Syria. And I think in general, the first, which I already alluded to, is the enduring defeat of the Islamic State. Keep in mind that this is not just about defeating the Islamic State as an army, where it only controls about two villages now. It's not just about defeating it right now, it's ensuring that it stays defeated. And also to help our partners in Syria and our partners in Iraq deal with what is already developing as insurgent groups and terrorists. And I've said for years that we should realize and think ahead to the time when the Islamic State army is defeated and its caliphate is eliminated, but recognize that what would happen at that time is you will see insurgent elements still in Iraq and presumably in Syria, and also terrorist capabilities, terrorist cells, much like what we had to deal with during some of the periods of the counterinsurgency operations that we conducted and supported in Iraq. So again, first dealing with ISIS on an enduring basis, which requires some degree of enduring presence, however it might be configured. And then second, as I mentioned earlier, ensuring that Iran can't proceed with some of the plans that it would like to implement, especially the establishment of the ground line of communications. And then third, we really need to look to the needs of our partners on the ground, the Syrian Kurds and the Syrian Arabs, whom we have enabled, to be sure, to defeat the Islamic State and to reclaim their territory in the eastern and northeastern part of Syria from the extremist caliphate. But again, we need to ensure that the ultimate political arrangement there ensures their security, ensures a degree of autonomy, ensures their safety. And indeed, we need to help them rebuild their communities as well. So again, I think there's a lot of work that has to be done if these objectives are to be pursued and achieved, noting that, again, some of them require an enduring presence in some form.
So let's end with the policy toward the Iranian regime that Trump took, which is basically economic sanctions. I mean, economic pressure by sanctions that are supposed to be the ultimate weapon of Trump against the Iranian nuclear project, as well as other activities. But do you think that this tool alone can be effective to bring the Iranian to negotiations back again, and maybe also, as Trump once said, to lead eventually to a regime change based on all what we see in the streets of Tehran recently?
Well, first, I don't think that economic sanctions alone would describe the policy that's being pursued, much less a policy that should be pursued. There should always be a comprehensive policy. And with respect, I don't think I'd characterize the economic sanctions as the ultimate weapon against Iran. I think the ultimate weapon is actual weapons, and those are always lurking on the western side of the Gulf. And Iran knows the capabilities that we have. It certainly can presume that there are contingency plans for dealing with a variety of scenarios involving Iran, including should they ever be on the threshold, certainly, of a nuclear system of some type. But certainly the economic sanctions, I think, are very, very significant. And I think they come at a time when there's a degree of vulnerability, there's a degree of unrest in Iran. I'm not at all talking about regime change, but I am talking about a degree of fragility in Iran that I don't think has been seen in recent years, certainly not since the demonstrations that followed the presidential election some, I guess it's 6 or 7 years ago now. What you are seeing across Iran is a degree of spontaneity in demonstrations. This is not all concentrated in Tehran. There is no political leader who was not elected and who, in a sense, mobilized the masses through a variety of means. These are spontaneous reactions to unmet expectations. The Iranian people thought that if the nuclear deal was agreed, the sanctions were lifted, that they would see an enormous improvement in their economy. And they did not see that. And they certainly will not see that now that sanctions have been reimposed. Again, this is a well-educated, entrepreneurial society, famous for its businessmen and so forth and business people. And the sanctions come at a time when, again, there is this sentiment in the population. Oil prices have come down considerably. And so I think that Iran actually could come back to the negotiating table. I don't think that that is at all out of the question, whether it's this year or next year. And it will be very, very difficult for the leadership indeed to take that path. But I think that they may actually conclude at some point, and the regime may conclude, that, you know, we've got to get out from underneath these sanctions. Is it really worth carrying out all of what we see as malign activities? Is it really worth continuing to test missiles? And certainly, would it be really worth restarting the nuclear program or exceeding the thresholds that have been imposed by the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Agreement? Would that be worth it, given the pain that they're already feeling right now? So I think this could be a moment in which Iran does some real soul searching and ends up perhaps at some point in the next year or two returns to the negotiating table.
Thank you very much.
I thank you.